You're listening to a recorded talk from Greenbelt Festival.
Good afternoon, Hot House. That made you jump, didn't it? Hello and welcome. It's great that you're here. We're really looking forward to what we're going to be doing this afternoon. I'm really pleased to welcome Carla Denyer. Carla is co-leader of the Green Party and Member of Parliament for Bristol Central. She is here to talk to us about faith in politics, and I'm sure many of us will have at times sort of despaired or hoped or wanted something different out of our national politics, and I'm so looking forward to, Carla, to hearing what you have to tell us and what you'll share. So over to you.
Awesome. Thank you. I get angry when I encounter something that isn't fair. I want to fix it. And I've been like that for as long as I can remember. I expect most, if not all of you, have been like that too. And I'm going to start this afternoon by telling you a few stories. First of all, we're going to wind back to 16, 17-year-old Carla. Oh, thank you. Sound crew, they can't hear. I'll angle this a bit more towards my face, but does it want to be closer, maybe? Could you give me a hand? Thank you. We're just sorting the sound, one sec. Oh, it's off. Testing, testing, 1, 2. I think maybe even closer if you can manage it. Yeah, perfect. Bloody mic stands. How's that? Is that better? Great. Thank you, whoever it was that called that out. So, hi, everyone. I'm Carla. Thank you all for being here. I'm a bit humbled by the crowd. So, as I was saying, I frequently get angry when I encounter something that isn't fair. I've always been that way for as long as I can remember, and I expect that most, if not all of you, feel the same way. So I'm going to start this afternoon by telling you a few stories, because I've been asked to tell you about my journey to where I am now. We're going to start with 16 or maybe 17-year-old Carla in sixth form college. I got angry when I found out that the people who make the tea, the coffee, the sugar, the hot chocolate, the orange juice that was served in the canteen at my sixth form college were not paid enough to live on. Because the leaders of the big businesses that manufacture and sell those products, they didn't care about the well-being of the people that made them. And frankly, they felt that they could get away with it because those people growing those products were out of sight and therefore out of mind. They could hide the borderline slavery working conditions that those people were forced to work in because they lived thousands of miles away. They lived in other cultures. They spoke other languages and, dare I say it, they pretty much all had brown skin. So I joined the Make Trade Fair campaign. This was back in the days, some of you will remember, when you couldn't get fair trade products in the supermarket. You had to go to the church hall for 2 hours on Saturday afternoon. And so there was a campaign to make fair trade more normal. And me and a group of friends got together and lobbied the sixth form college to stock fair trade products in the canteen. They said no. Because the contract wasn't just for our college, it was for the whole region. Long story short, we didn't take that first no for an answer. We kept pushing, and in the end, they changed the contract for the whole region. At exactly the same time, when I was in sixth form, I was also part of the Stop the War campaign, because this was at exactly the moment that the previous Labour government was on the brink of taking us into war in Iraq. And that one had a bit of a different outcome. I helped organise two coaches full of people to go from the town where my sixth form was up to London for the big demo. 1 million people marched and nothing changed. We went to war anyway. So what these two parallel experiences taught me when I was in college is that campaigning works sometimes, and sometimes it doesn't. But that sometimes is better than never, which is what you'll get if you don't try. And I also learned not to take the first no for a final answer. So that was one of my formative experiences. Fast forward a few years, 22-year-old Carla. I'd been getting more and more worried about the climate. It wasn't an overnight epiphany, but over the period of about 3 months in the summer holiday between my second and third years at uni, I realised that climate isn't just an issue that you learn about at school. It is the biggest issue facing humanity, and it wasn't even a decision, it was a realisation that I would be committing the rest of my life to trying to sort it out. And why did it make me so angry? Why was climate the one that got me? For exactly the same reason that the unfair wages of the chocolate and coffee growers made me so angry in sixth form. Because the people at the sharpest end of the climate crisis, those already suffering back then and certainly suffering now from rising sea levels, more extreme weather, unreliable harvests, were people in places like Bangladesh who had done the least to contribute to the climate crisis but were paying the highest price. And why was that injustice not headline news on the TV every day? Because they're thousands of miles away and they're too easy to forget. And then not long after my epiphany, I realised that my college at university, I think there's quite a few Durham University alumni here, by the way. Hello. I've bumped into about half a dozen of you already. But anyway, my college, St. Chad's College at Durham Uni, where I lived, wasn't doing even the bare minimum because they weren't providing facilities for students to recycle. In our bedrooms, in our corridors, in the buildings we lived in, everything had to go into general waste to go to landfill. And so I stood for election as the environment rep for my JCR, starting very small, and I made the case that students should get those recycling facilities, and it worked. And what that experience taught me, we got those recycling bins the following year, was the importance of getting a variety of different stakeholders on side, because again, I wasn't successful immediately. I was successful when I managed to make the financial case to the bursar of the college that because paying to get a skip's worth of recycling taken away costs less than paying to get a skip's worth of landfill waste taken away, it was a no-brainer from a balancing the books point of view, even if you don't care about the environment. I also had to get the cleaning staff on side. So what did that teach me? Yeah, the importance of seeing things from different people's points of view. But about 3-4 months ago, I got an email to my MP email address from a guy, turns out to be my successor. He's the environment rep for St. Chad's College Junior Common Room this year. He didn't know this. He knew I'd been in that position. He didn't know the story that I'd got the recycling in. But he was emailing to ask for my advice in how to persuade the college to provide recycling facilities for the students. Yeah, that's right. In 2025, at least one college at Durham University doesn't give recycling bins in the student accommodation. So what that experience has taught me is that progress is not guaranteed and that things can go backwards as well as forwards. And I feel like anyone who has been watching the news for the last few years could tell you that, but I still think it's a pivotal thing to understand. And I had quite a rude awakening on that a few years ago, having a conversation with a quite close friend, left-leaning progressive friend, his attitude was that progress is inevitable. And so he didn't feel like he needed to be an activist on equality or poverty or climate because we would make gradual progress over time and we would get there in the end. And so you could relax. Needless to say, I don't agree. I wouldn't have been doing all this stuff if I agreed. Anyway, back to 23-year-old Carla. I was a final year at uni. I was an activist on environment, peace, human rights, you name it. And I realised that many of the activists that I respected the most in terms of their integrity and the way they worked inclusively, a lot of them were Quakers. Now, I didn't grow up as a Quaker. I was and still am an atheist, or at a push agnostic, but I felt really drawn to Quakerism. It's, I expect a lot of you know if you're at Greenbelt, but Quakerism is a faith, or one could argue a philosophy or a practice, that's rooted in Christianity, but is entirely accessible and compatible to those of other faiths and none. I know a Catholic Quaker, I met a Muslim Quaker the other day, and there are many non-theist Quakers like myself. We Quakers avoid hierarchy wherever we can. That was one of the things that appealed to me about the way these Quakers that I met worked. Because Quakerism kind of started because Quakers believe that we don't need someone to stand at the front and mediate our relationship with God and tell us how to manage that relationship. We believe that everyone can have a direct relationship with God, and that we minister, the verb, we do the ministering ourselves at meetings rather than having a minister at the front. Quakers also believe that there is that of God in everyone, and that's a phrase that really resonates with me even as a non-theist. It's something that is important but can be so hard to remember, but I think it's especially important if you're a peace activist, because that means that nobody is pure good and nobody is pure evil. And in Quakerism, it's really important to live our testimonies, which is why so many Quakers are activists, because we're not the kind to sit back and trust that it's all in God's plan. Here's a phrase that I love, even though I'm non-theist: God has no hands but ours. I got really involved in Quakerism around the end of uni and for a few years after that, including getting involved in Young Friends General Meeting. Again, I know that there are some former Young Friends General Meeting, probably some current ones too here. Hi. And I was part of a small group of young Quakers who successfully persuaded Quakers in Britain, the national body, to become the first major faith group in the UK to divest from fossil fuels. Thank you. There's a lot more I could tell you about my Quaker journey, but I don't want to bore everyone. So I'm going to say I invite questions on that if you want to know more. Back to the story. Fast forward 3 more years to 26-year-old Carla. I've moved to Bristol. I work in engineering for a renewable energy consultancy, helping to get wind farms built. And in my spare time, I'm still a climate activist and a peace activist and so on. And I realise 2 things around the same time. One is, in my day job, the UK is not building renewable energy as fast as I would like it to. But the reason for that isn't the technology. It's not that the engineering isn't there. For the most part, there's still some areas where the engineering work is really important. But for the most part, the reason we're not building wind farms and solar farms faster is a lack of political will. And in my spare time, I'm organising protests, helping to set up organisations that are providing the alternative themselves, like energy co-ops and so on. And I'm writing to my elected representatives to ask them to vote the right way. And I realise that I don't want to spend the rest of my life writing to my MP, asking them to vote the right way on every individual vote, every individual bill. So even though it is really quite hard to get Greens elected in this current unfair first-past-the-post system, it might actually be easier in the long run than the alternative of writing to MPs from other parties, pleading with them to do the right thing for the rest of my life. So I joined the Green Party. thank you. I did so with absolutely zero intention of me being a politician myself. I was joining to help out, to give them a bit of my money, a bit of my time. I was actually persuaded to do so by someone who is here at this event. No political ambition for myself. I just wanted to help an organisation that I knew shared my values to succeed and get more people that I agreed with in the room, in the corridors of power. Roll on a few more years, 29-year-old Carla is one of the core volunteers in the 2015 campaign to try and get a Green MP elected in Bristol West. I'm part of the core team of half a dozen people. And one of the other people in that core team who had a bit more experience with election campaigning than me explained that for small parties, one of the best ways of getting Green MPs elected, I mean, we'd only done it once at that point, in this country, but elsewhere, is to already have hardworking Green councillors in the local area. And we already had loads of hardworking Green councillors in Bristol, but not in a couple of the key areas within Bristol West. And so he said, well, you know, you could do it. And I said, no, I'm not a politician. Anyway, long story short, turns out that thing about not taking the first no for a final answer, that goes both ways. So I said no about half a dozen times, and eventually I said yes. And I said yes mostly because I knew that because the boundary changes were coming, I was only actually standing for election to be a councillor for 1 year, and then there was going to be another election. So I had a really easy get out if I didn't like it. But turns out, actually, it was okay. So I stood for election again as a councillor, and yeah, it's a long story, but somehow I ended up being the co-leader of the Green Party and an MP. And at each stage, it wasn't that I had any ambition or grand plan. It was that and I'm sure many of you who are activists will identify with this, I had, at each decision point, I was just deciding in that fork in the road, how can I have the most impact? What's the best thing I can do in this situation? Where can I lend my elbow grease? And at each of those decision points, I got persuaded to stand for election. Now that I am an MP, in my job, I meet people often once or twice a week often, this is going to sound like a bit of a shady thing, but you'll see where I'm going, who come up to me and say, I'd like to be a politician. And when I ask them for which party and what their passion is, they don't know. What it is that they want to change, they don't know. One of them even explicitly said, how do I get where you are? With no sign of any burning injustice that they want to solve, that propels them out of bed in the morning with the conviction that they need to do everything in their power to fix it. Just a vague impression that it sounds fun and they like the idea of having some power. That gives me the chills. In contrast, I meet dozens, sometimes hundreds of people every week who are furiously angry at the injustices they see in the world or that they face directly themselves, but have absolutely no intention of becoming a politician themselves because they think it looks awful and they don't want to be part of it. I identify. Again, I expect there's probably quite a few of you in this tent. So to you, I would gently say, if you want more of the latter kind of people in politics, and maybe fewer of the former, maybe that means that some of those people need to be you. Just saying. Fast forward of 3 or 4 more years. 33-year-old Carla has been a councillor for a few years on Bristol City Council now. And still getting very, very, very worried about the climate. And a climate activist I knew came to me and shared with me this idea that he'd heard about from some councils elsewhere in the world of declaring a climate emergency. At the time, one councillor, a guy called Trent McCarthy, a Green councillor in Australia, and two councillors in the US had put forward a motion that had passed on their councils declaring a climate emergency. And it makes sense that it comes from those countries because in Australia, they already have a lot of extreme weather. So the idea of declaring an emergency is already in the Australian psyche. But my friend explains this idea and asks me if I would consider having a go in Bristol. And I said, yeah, of course, I love the idea. And I think what particularly appealed to me is the whole concept of declaring a climate emergency is that you are recognising that this is an intolerable situation. Things cannot go on as they are. Something has to change. And you are committing to changing it. but you're not getting too hung up on exactly the minutiae of how you're going to get there at the first stage. Because if you do that, you'll never take the first step. It's a little bit like the 12-step method that Alcoholics Anonymous and others use. The first step is recognizing that there is a problem and then recognizing that you have something has to change. You don't need to know what the end goal is or even have much faith you're going to get there. You just have to be willing to take the next step. That was the concept behind getting Bristol to declare a climate emergency and commit to much more ambitious carbon reduction targets. So I wrote this motion. And in the 3 months or so it took me to write it, not single-handedly, working with lots of others, a lot of lucky things happened. There was extreme weather and wildfires all over Europe. You see what I mean about lucky. The IPCC came out with its first 1.5 degree report that showed quite how bad even 1.5 degrees of warming was going to be, let alone two. And the very, very beginnings of the Extinction Rebellion movement started, and the first event happened in London. And that meant that by the time the motion that I'd been writing for the last 3 months actually got on the agenda for a meeting in November 2018, climate was in the news, it was in the zeitgeist in a way that hadn't been the case for 10 years at least. And so word got around about my motion. And people, climate activists, brand new members of XR, people from other groups like Friends of the Earth, individuals, wrote to their councillors in numbers that they'd never seen before. Every councillor on Bristol City Council got at least a few emails or letters from residents in their wards saying, please vote for this. I am paying attention. I will notice whether you have or not, and I will take it into account when I vote in the next election. And so the councillors of all parties felt the pressure. And even though my climate emergency motion wasn't fundamentally different from anything else that Green councillors have been putting forward on councils for the last few decades, it caught the moment. And so my motion passed. It passed unanimously. It was the first climate emergency declaration in Europe. And it set off a tidal wave of similar declarations all over the UK and Western Europe amongst councils, but also other organisations, universities, museums and so on. Thank you. Thank you. But my point is that I don't think I played a particularly strong part in that. And I think that what made it work was lots of different people and organisations coming from slightly different perspectives with a similar goal in mind, but it doesn't have to be identical, using different methods, perhaps with slightly different values, but all pushing towards roughly the same goal from inside and outside the system. That and the timing, that was what did it. And then fast forward a few more years to the 39-year-old Carla that is standing before you today, looking back over my journey for what there is to learn about politics and specifically about hope. I'm skipping over the last 6 years where I carried on as a councillor, worked for an MEP, stood to be MEP, stood to be MP unsuccessfully the first time, then got elected as co-leader of the party, then got elected as an MP, because we will be here all day if we do that. But I am happy to answer any questions. But somehow I went from being an engineer and climate activist who was extremely sceptical about party politics as a way of achieving any positive change to being a member of parliament and a leader of a political party. So how did that happen? Well, I'll be blunt with you, with a reference back to the title of this talk, Faith in Politics. It is certainly not that I have faith in the current UK political system as it's currently set up to deliver progressive change. I do not. It's that I believe we need it to deliver positive change. And that the best way of making it better, the best way of shaking it out of its dysfunctional, disproportional, vested interest-ridden state is to have more people like me that are pissed off with it inside the system, pushing for change and not putting up with the status quo. Thank you. Now, the organisers of this festival, when they booked me to speak, they asked me to talk about my journey into politics through activism and Quakerism. But they also wanted me to answer two specific questions. One, does democracy still work? Is the political route the best route to combat climate change? Or do we need to act outside of that, community organising, direct action, etc.? And two, what is the role of green politics in the wider context? Now, you might have a hint of my answers already from what I've told you about my journey, but let's get into it a little bit more. Is the political route, the party political route, the best route to combat climate change? Or do we need to act outside of that? Both. Both. The answer is both. One of the biggest differences between the Green Party and other political parties in the UK is that we believe that there is an important role for protest and non-violent direct action in bringing about positive change in the world, and you only need to look at democracies where protest is stamped down on to see the chilling effect that has. And that is literally written into the 10 core founding principles of the Green Party. And many, many Green Party members are also active in other groups outside of party politics. Everything from putting up bird boxes and letter writing to chaining themselves to things, from trade unions to community allotments to volunteering at their local mosque and everything in between. Because we live that understanding that collaboration and community, grassroots, bottom-up organising, things being done with people rather than to people, with decisions made at the lowest practical level, that's the best way to bring about positive and lasting change. And the Green Party is part of that ecosystem. And our particular role in that ecosystem is the party politics. It is to achieve change through the political process. But that doesn't mean that we think that all other routes are invalid. But our job is to get Green Party people elected at all levels of government, national, regional and local, to directly deliver the policies that create the country and the world that we want to live in, to bring about the climate justice, the social justice, the economic justice, the racial justice. Because the thing is, nearly every council in the UK has declared a climate emergency now, and many of them brought in ambitious carbon reduction targets with it. And that became politically possible in large part because of the climate campaigners outside the town and city halls. But the person who actually wrote the motion, working closely with others, mind, put it forward and argued the case in the council chamber, well, that was a Green councillor. And I'm sorry, but I don't think that a councillor from another party would have done that. And not only that, the second and the third people who proposed climate emergency declarations in the UK to take up the baton and to realise that they could do the same in their borough or their city halls, Forest of Dean and London Assembly, by the way, shout out to the first two that copied it. And honestly, I've never been happier to have my homework copied. They were both Greens too. And some of you might have seen the TED talk by a chap called Derek Sivers, who said that it is the first followers who turn something into a movement, and that until they get involved, it's just a lone nut. That was his phrase. So I'll let you decide if that's the case. For so many campaigns to be successful, you need people pushing for change from the outside and the inside. You need that pincer movement that sometimes they're in explicit cooperation, sometimes they're not. But that is often the secret sauce that makes campaigns work. And my evidence for that goes beyond my experience with the climate emergency declaration as a councillor. You can look at our first year as a team of four Green MPs in Parliament too. So we went from one MP to four Green MPs in July last year. And we got elected at a time when people were sick of the status quo, had had enough of cuts to public services, of inaction on climate, on failure to make people's lives better across the board. But instead of offering positive change, this new government has given us more of the same. From cutting support for disabled people to backing airport expansion that literally flies in the face of the climate science, from failing to lift the two-child benefit cap, which would instantly lift hundreds of thousands of children out of poverty, to plans that would give developers the green light to bulldoze over nature and a get-out-of-jail-free card for building affordable social housing. From continuing to sell weapons and parts to the Israeli government committing a genocide in Gaza, to attacks on our fundamental right to protest and point that out. Labour has failed to live up to the promise of change in this country that people so desperately want and need. But time and time again, having Greens in the room last year, over the last year, has allowed us to challenge the litany of wrong decisions and push for better and secure better. Solar panels on roofs of all new build homes, expanding access to free school meals, the government's U-turn on the winter fuel allowance, creating a new natural history GCSE, cracking down on dodgy landlords, defending investment in the Warm Homes Plan when the government was thinking of cutting it, and forcing a climb down on cuts to personal independence payments for disabled people. Greens, and again, you'll notice a theme here, I don't claim sole responsibility, but Greens played a leading role in securing every single one of those climb downs, rethinks and achievements in winning positive change. Thank you. And we did that working in parallel with NGOs, unions, faith groups and millions of dedicated campaigners from outside Parliament. And in the bread and butter daily work of being an MP in Parliament, I've often been one of the few voices dragging the government to the left when everyone else is pulling in the opposite direction. As an MP, you're too kind. As an MP on the Renters' Rights Bill Committee, straight after the election last year, I was able to raise big ideas like rent controls, which I think is the perfect example of Greens putting forward compelling, evidence-based alternatives designed to transform business as usual, putting things on the agenda that simply no other party was willing to touch. And I've used my position as an MP to commission research that the government certainly wouldn't be commissioning, like a report by the refugee and migration expert Zoe Gardner into the dysfunctionality of the Home Office and how we could do better, actually, if we dismantled the Home Office entirely and replaced it with two different departments with different remits. Have you ever, by the way, thought how screwed up it is that crime and migration are in the same government department? Do you think that that might engender some unhelpful attitudes? So we put out a report that goes beyond a sort of single sassy sentence and into, okay, but what might that actually look like and how would it work and which departments would you put it into? Long story short, you put immigration with functions that deal with infrastructure so that you're making sure that communities have the infrastructure to meet the needs of the people that already live there and the people that are coming. And as an MP, I managed to secure a commitment from Deputy Prime Minister Angela Rayner to read that report that nobody else would have commissioned and put to her if I hadn't. So, on committees behind the scenes, on big votes in the House of Commons, in PMQs like that was, we Greens have collaborated with other MPs on areas where we agree, while not being afraid to speak up when we know we have something unique to offer. Something, though, that I have often felt a tension about in my year and a bit as an MP is pushing for change inside the system, the parliamentary system, versus using my growing political platform outside in the wider world, realising our potential to a more outwards facing transformative political force. And I don't necessarily think I've got that right yet. It's a growing edge for me. But I know that it's crucial because if the last year has taught us anything, it is that two-party politics is over. It's done. And that, I believe, is a good thing. It could lead to the creation of a more diverse and dynamic political landscape with more people feeling represented and with trust in politics starting to be restored and rebuilt. It could signal a growing awareness of entrenched power structures and the importance of naming and focusing on who is standing in the way of meaningful change. And it could be a significant moment for the Greens to make our next big breakthrough, so that environmental, social, racial and economic justice are put permanently at the heart of the mainstream political agenda. But there's also a risk that the end of two-party politics could take us down a different path altogether, one which sees democracy eroded still further, nuance chased out of town, the press silenced, political dissent outlawed, and a Trump wannabe in number 10. All of this enabled by a government drifting to the right, pandering to prejudice, and lacking moral backbone, that either can't or won't articulate a compelling vision of a greener, fairer, safer world for us all. Now, since being elected as an MP, being up close to where political power lies for the last year, what I've seen is that no political party other than the Greens is making those connections between the systemic problems and what it is that is making people so angry and fearful. No political party other than the Greens is setting out those long-term, win-win-win hopeful solutions that properly connect with the day-to-day challenges that people are experiencing on the sharp end of the cost of living crisis and the everything else crisis that's happening right now. No other political party is pointing to and calling out the vested interests that exert huge influence and power on politics. Did you know that between 2019 and 2024, 93% of the political donations to the Reform Party were by fossil fuel companies, individual fossil fuel millionaires and billionaires, and climate deniers. 93%. And no other political party is capturing the idea that the British government needs a new mindset, not just new management. This last year, for us four new Green MPs, has been all about laying the foundations, first of all, the party building for the next stage, our four brand new Green MPs, building our teams, setting up our offices, learning how to navigate the incredibly arcane, regressive system that is UK democracy, and then blowing the roof off. Whether it's wealth taxes, climate limits, climate jobs, climate justice, climate resilience, dismantling the Home Office, universal free childcare, reimagining the economy to actually deliver well-being for people rather than just infinite economic growth. Building homes fit for the future that don't need to immediately be retrofitted. Ensuring rights for nature, trans equality, free social care, or simply the intrinsic importance of dignity, compassion, and hope. That is our project in the Green Party. Now, am I up here today to say that you must join the Green Party to be the one true way to bring about the kingdom of heaven on earth? No, of course not. Of course not. That's clearly not the theme of the whole talk I've done right up until now. Each to their own. You must go where your passion is and where you personally think that you can make the most difference, or as Quakers say, where the spirit leads you. But I am here to say that if you, like me, are angry about the state of the world, and you, like me, recognise that we do need more Greens in the room where it happens, asking the questions, proposing the policies, and putting things on the agenda that nobody else will, well then maybe this is your home. I'll end by quoting one of my favourite poems. In fact, it is the whole poem, a short one, by poet Jared K. Anderson. We seldom admit the seductive comfort of hopelessness. It saves us from ambiguity. It has an answer for every question. There's just no point. Hope, on the other hand, is messy. Because if it all might work out, then we have things to do. We must weather the possibility of happiness. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you all very much, and thank you so much to Carla for sharing us with us in such an inspiring way through this afternoon. We are going to attempt to take questions. You will all appreciate with the number of you that have turned out, this is going to be a little bit challenging, but we will do our best. What we're going to do is my fellow host, Michael, who you can just see working along there, will have a microphone over there. Once I've finished speaking to you, I will have a microphone over there. Carla will call on people to ask questions. If you're called on, please make your way to Michael or to me as best you can to ask your question. Please do keep your questions short and to the point.
And questions.
And questions, that's what I was about to say. This isn't the time for stories, statements or whatever. Ask a question. And if people near you are needing to make their way to ask a question, please, in a lovely greenbelt way, help them to get through, make some space so that hopefully we can do it.
Cool. And I think on that basis, I will pick the questions in groups of three so that questioner two and three can start wiggling through the crowd while question one is being asked. Oh, it's back on now. Great. Okay, so I can see a few hands. I'm going to pick this person in the baseball cap, first of all, and then there is someone right at the back with greyish, whitish hair. I can't really see in the light there. You know who you are, that person. And three down here in the flowery top or dress. Yeah.
Thank you for that, Carla. Farage is set to be the next Prime Minister, according to many polls. And so I wonder, given the fact that we desperately need a new direction and we don't need Farage, what are you going to do about Jeremy and Zara?
Cool. I'll take the next two questions if they're up and then loop them all together. So go for it.
Oh, okay. Sort of related question about tribalism. Part of what you said seemed to be very much about the necessity of bridging differences, working with others who aren't necessarily aligned with you. As someone who's stayed, for better or worse, with Labour, knocking doors for the last 20 years, I see it as a very tribal party that dismisses the others. And I hear in your talk a bit of both. The uniqueness and the strength of the Greens, but also a willingness to work across. I wonder what risks you're willing to take as the co-leader of the Green Party to bridge differences and work with others, even though you may see them as imperfect. And I'm thinking of Jeremy Corbyn, I'm thinking of the Lib Dems, I'm thinking of a progressive left coalition, because one of the characteristics of our politics is very tribal.
Okay, thank you.
One more this side, Carla.
Yep. Yeah.
My question is, when you feel like you're fighting a losing battle in terms of climate, social justice, what do you cling on to? How do you keep going? How do you keep fighting?
Cool, thank you. I'm going to do those in reverse order because I know immediately what my answer is to that one and I want to say it while it's fresh in my head. The nature of being an activist is often being disappointed. And it isn't always easy. I think, and I don't necessarily think I've always got it right. Like, I get downhearted as well, just like anyone. I do think that being involved in whatever sense in being an whether it's as an activist or a green politician, is much less depressing than not. Like, the best solution to climate anxiety is doing something. But when I do feel downheartened, two things. One, I try and make sure that I have a work-life balance and that I do take time off, because you can't run on empty. And I'm very lucky to have some very dear friends around me who are good at helping to make sure I do that. And the other is creative inspiration. So, like that poem that I shared at the end, I also get a lot of creative inspiration from Rebecca Solnit, who also writes about hope a lot, and has a similar passage that I have been known to quote, which describes hope as not an emotion, but an axe that you use to break down doors in an emergency. Hope is a tool that you can actively choose to have. It is not an emotion that passes over you. So I guess I actively choose to have it. The other two questions I'm going to roll in together because they're obviously related. It is, as you've heard, it's in the Green Party's DNA to work collaboratively across political parties and with non-political parties. I don't think that anyone has a monopoly on good ideas, although, of course, I think the Green Party has more good ideas than other parties. That's why I'm in it. Nodding to what the person over here said about how they heard, I guess, a mixture of me perhaps being a little bit tribal sometimes and thinking, I do think we probably have the best idea here, but, you know, I'm willing to collaborate. And I will always work with MPs across party lines on areas we agree and we already do. You know, I and Jeremy Corbyn and Zara Sultana and the other pro-Palestine independents and ex-Labour MPs and current lefty Labour MPs, we work with each other all of the time. We co-propose each other's early day motions. We vote on each other's amendments. We even do the telling, which is when you count the votes as we file through the lobbies for each other's amendments. So we always have and we always will collaborate with MPs where we agree with them, and we won't let party lines get in the way. On the Jeremy Corbyn Zara Sultana project specifically, I mean, it at the moment it's a mailing list. At the moment it isn't yet a political party. They haven't set any policies yet. So I very much, you know, wish them well, and we'll definitely collaborate with whatever comes out of this, I'm sure, in some way or another. But it is a little bit hard to comment on something that so far is just a mailing list, that because I don't know exactly what it is I'm commenting on. So I'm sure that some level of cooperation will be possible, but it's a little bit early to say exactly what. I have to say also, and please correct me if I'm wrong, but I haven't seen any statements that have come out of this project so far that have proposed anything that isn't already Green Party policy. So if anyone is looking for a left-wing vehicle for power and change in this country, the Greens are already here right now. We're surging, we're growing in members all of the time. We have a well-established party infrastructure that has already elected hundreds of people to all levels of government. We're here right now. Join us. Right, let's do some more questions. There is someone in a white t-shirt just here. There is someone sitting down in a sort of teal-coloured top there. Well, let's pick some people outside. Can I see any hands out there? I can see someone in with red hair and maybe dungarees. I can't quite tell. There, yes, you. And whoever gets to the mic first, go for it.
Thank you. Just two words. Why Zach?
Can I just clarify something? So this is about Zach Polanski, who is one of the candidates for the leadership of the Green Party. I'm very much staying independent in the leadership election. So if you're asking why am I backing someone, I'm not. So that might not be a question for me, but for other people in the Green Party, possibly. But can I clarify?
Because the statement on the Green Party hustings has a comment from your office about Zach that seemed very positive.
That's news to me. I will check that later. So for clarity for anyone that's not following the minutiae of ins and outs in the Green Party, so in the Green Party, we have leadership elections on a regular basis. Unlike the other parties, I was absolutely flabbergasted when I discovered this. Every other political party in the UK does not have internal elections for its leadership on a regular basis. They just wait for a mutiny. Like, they believe in democracy externally, but they don't want their members to get a regular chance to vote for their leaders. Yeah, whereas in the Greens, we just have internal elections on a regular basis. And then when we do it, journalists are like, but isn't this instability? Why? And it's, well, is it better to, like, wait for a coup? Anyway, so, yeah, so it is one of our regular chances to have an internal election. I've been co-leader of the party with Adrian Ramsey for the last 4 years. I've decided not to re-stand in this leadership election, not because I've been having a bad time or anything, but just because I want to really focus. I'm quite a nerd. I really want to sort of get into the details of my new job as an MP. And who knows, maybe I'll return to the leadership at some point in the future. But for the next few years, I really want to get my teeth into some of the projects, commission some new research and so on in my job as an MP. So I'm not re-standing, but my current co-leader, Adrian, is standing with one of the other Green MPs, Ellie, and our current deputy leader, Zach Polansky, is standing to be leader as well. Because I will work closely with whoever wins, I'm being neutral on that internal election and letting the members decide. And I'm excited to find out who is going to be leading our party in just over a week. Anyway, next question.
I live in Epping, so some of you will have seen the chairman of our council on 9 o'clock news. They have, I think, declared a climate emergency. Their climate plan says things like, we would aim to, we hope to, it would be good if we could. How do we do something with that?
Thank you. The third one? Hello.
Do I hold it or you hold it? You hold it. Hello. I was thinking, I don't often think of a politician as an activist, other than when I hear you talk, I guess just because you're an icon. So how do you balance being both a politician and an activist? And do you find that either side of that ends up lacking or not getting enough attention because you're trying to do both at once?
Thank you. Thanks. Okay. Epping, yeah, I'm sorry. So help me out if you're still anywhere near the mic or possibly shout. Who was in administration on Epping Council when the climate emergency was declared? Do you know? Okay, so I'll repeat that because I know not everyone will have heard. It's a Conservative majority on Epping Council, but there are quite a lot of Liberal Democrats as well. So the thing about the climate emergency declarations is that while it started with Greens, other parties, and, you know, I'm really happy about this, other parties picked it up, and we had councillors from all sorts of different parties proposing similar climate emergency declarations on their councils. However, some of the ones proposed by councillors from other parties watered them down a bit. And I think that's what we've just heard in that question, that the way it was phrased in Epping was, we would aim to and we would like to. Whereas the wording in my one was, Bristol City Council declares a climate emergency and commits to. And, you know, the carbon reduction targets that I had in that motion, I knew were crazy ambitious, but they were also what was required by the climate science. And you've got to have ambitious targets in that situation. And we now have Greens in administration on Bristol City Council, but we didn't for 6 years after that motion passed. So we weren't actually the ones able to deliver it ourselves for the first 6 years, unfortunately. But progress has been made. And now that we're in administration, maybe hopefully progress will accelerate. But yeah, it is a challenge because some of the politicians that proposed these motions did it absolutely in good faith. Some of them, I think, may have done it a little bit in a bandwagon jumpy kind of way. So I guess what you have to do is just hold them to account and keep on at them. Make sure that they know that you are still watching. In particular, Climate Emergency UK have done the climate scorecards of all councils in the UK. So go check them out. If you just Google climate scorecards, climate emergency, I'm sure you'll find it. And they've assessed all of the carbon reduction plans and the actual delivery, both, of all the councils in the UK using an army of volunteers going through lots of PDFs.
And they've ranked councils on lots of different elements of carbon reduction, nature, lots of other stuff. So go and have a look at that. See how Epping performs on that. And then you could perhaps particularly use that to lobby them, because seeing that you are near the bottom of a ranking is, I think, a particularly good way of persuading politicians that might otherwise not be very motivated. How do I balance being a politician and activist? I have to be honest with you. If you measure it in terms of hours and minutes a day, I am far more a politician than an activist now, but I am still very much an activist at heart, as you can see. That alongside being an engineer is my background. But yeah, I guess the way that I do being a politician is not being satisfied with a half-assed solution, and so always speaking up. So for me, it's not like, oh, right, better get to the protest now. It's more like, although there is a fair bit of that, it's more like when I'm in the House of Commons, I usually have a mindset of how could we make this better, rather than, ah, oh, good, that'll do, I'll go for tea. Cool. We've probably got time, not for another whole three, but maybe for one final question. Yes, you're suggesting someone. I can't see which of several people, but I'm going to let you choose and just... Okay, yeah.
This time when the love hearts.
It's a good sign.
Hi, as an activist and an engineer,
yeah,
and a Green, yeah, and a former parliamentary candidate,
ah,
and future council candidate, could I ask... if you would fully support Huddersfield in the north of England being a designated seat for the next general election, as we had the fourth biggest swing in the last general election.
Oh, very well done, very well done. So I'll give a bit of context for people that haven't been following Green Party success. So in the last general election, we went from 1 to 4 Green MPs, but we also we got nearly 2 million votes nationally, and we came second in a further 40 constituencies, which, yeah. We were not expecting anything like that. That was amazing, especially because in many of those constituencies, we hadn't really even campaigned very much. So that was just the base level of support without us going out and knocking on doors. And even in places where we didn't come second, there are lots of places. I can't remember off the top of my head. Did we come second in Huddersfield or we were still second in Huddersfield? Thank you. But there were also places where we came third, but it was still a massive swing. So I'm not going to make any commitments on specific constituencies up on stage without seeing the data. And also, it isn't solely my decision. But the Green Party is actively looking at which targets and how many targets are realistic for next time around. We're ambitious. 4 is absolutely not the ceiling. We want to grow. And the decisions about which seats to focus on will be based on how we did last time, but also how much... you know, volunteer resource there is in the local party, how popular the local MP is, and lots of other factors. So, yeah, it'll be seriously considered, I'm sure. I can promise you that. And I'm certainly hopeful that over the next few years, we will be able to build the party up, because, to be honest, it is resource rather than ambition is our only hurdle at the moment. So... the Conservative Party and the Reform have the billionaires. The Labour Party has lots and lots of union subs. The Green Party predominantly has individual small contributions from our tens of thousands of members. But our turnover is, I looked it up the other day, I think 1/16th of the turnover of Conservatives and Labour. So someone worked out straight after the last election that on a votes per pound spent basis, the graph is off the chart for the Greens. It's like, doink, like that. So we're feeling very pleased about what we managed to achieve with very limited resources, but we're also realistic that if we want to go from 4 to 20, 30, 40, 50 MPs next time, then we need to grow the party in numbers and raise some more funds, and also probably get a bit smarter about the way we do it. So if you want to be involved in that, you'd be very welcome. Thank you. Thank you so much, everyone. I really appreciate your attention and such a large number of you turning out. Thank you.
Thanks so much for listening to this recorded talk. Explore our full Greenbelt Festival Talks archive with almost 20 years of recorded talks and podcasts for free at greenbelt.org.uk/talks.